Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 9 for August 31st, 2007, Patent Nonsense. This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audible.com/twit. We'd like to thank Victor Kajiao for help with this podcast. You can listen to Victor's own podcast, The Typical Mac User, at typicalmacuser.com/WordPress, and Immigration Tales at immigrationtales.com.
Hi, and welcome back to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, your host, and I'm really excited today because I've been looking forward to doing a patent episode of This Week in Law, and I've got today with us three really wonderful patent lawyers and bloggers from around the country, two of whom are in Idaho, Brad Frazier and Steve Nipper, both in Boise, Idaho, right down the street from one another. Hi, Brad and Steve.
Hi, Denise.
Great to have you on the call. And also joining us from Ohio is Matt Buchanan. Hi, Matt. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Denise. Thanks for having me.
So I've been super excited to put together a patent episode of TWiL because there has just been so much going on, and I'm not a patent lawyer, so my head just kind of spins with all of this stuff. But I am quite interested in the patent arena, obviously, since I do practice in the technology area. I'm really glad that you guys have come on board today to help us understand some of the current events in the patent arena and some of the overall trends that are much in the news today. For example, I was recently at the Always On Stanford Summit here in California and attended a panel that was all on the patent crisis, the supposed patent crisis in our country. And most of the attorneys who were patent counsel for IBM, Apple, and I'm blanking on the third company right now, but they all kind of backpedaled on the notion that there was an enormous crisis in the patent system, but that certainly there is room for improvement. And I'm wondering what all of you think. Are we facing a patent crisis, or are things just chugging along kind of okay?
Well, Denise, this is Brad, and by in the way of full disclosure, I'm actually not a patent attorney, but I have practiced in that arena, and I've done a lot of patent licensing and some patent litigation. So, and I've also worked for a number of years in-house in the hardware industry, so I have that perspective on it. And so do I think, as a non-patent practitioner, is there a crisis? I think in certain areas there's a crisis. And let me just offer this as my initial observation, and that is in respect to what the current patent environment is doing to certain high technology companies, in particular hardware companies. I think that's a crisis. But I'm interested in what Steve and Matt have to say from their perspective as actual patent practitioners.
Yeah, and let's clarify for our listeners what that exactly means. I don't know if people are all that familiar with the fact that there is a whole separate bar for patent lawyers and a separate bar exam that needs to be taken, and that many of the people who go into patent practice and decide to study for and take that bar exam have been working in the engineering or otherwise in the high-tech field for quite some time before they do that. Is that right, Matt and Steve?
Yeah, that is right, Denise. It's most licensed patent attorneys have a technical background, biological sciences, chemistry, engineering of some sort, and they've taken and passed that separate bar exam that you speak about. But that doesn't mean that all people that call themselves patent attorneys are licensed under that bar. Certainly, there's a lot of patent litigators out there that have not taken and passed the bar exam. It's really something that's focused on the patent prosecution side of things, which is preparing and filing applications with the patent office and going through the procedure of actually acquiring a patent through the prosecution process.
And that's what you do, correct?
I do a little bit of everything. Prosecution's probably a I'd say a little bit less than half of what I do, and then there's opinion work and litigation and things like that.
I should mention that all of you have been around in the blogosphere, and I've read your blogs for, you know, as long as I can remember, but none of us have met before, so it's great to have you all together on the phone today and doing the show. So, Steve, how about you? What is your practice focus on?
My practice, you know, I actually work in a small firm, and in this small firm, your practice is based upon the clients you end up with just over time and through networking, and probably 40% of the work I do is actually trademark work, with the rest of it being a mix of both patent prosecution as well as patent litigation. And, you know, and Matt's dead on when he explains what it takes to, or what a typical patent attorney is. From the standpoint, you've got registered patent attorneys, which means they're registered to prosecute applications before the patent office, but there are lots of patent litigators that aren't necessarily patent attorneys.
So what do you guys think of this notion that the patent system in our country and elsewhere is in crisis?
It depends on who's defining it and depends on what aspect of it they're defining. Obviously, you know, software and hardware have their own issues with patents themselves versus, you know, outside of that area, there are problems with pendency and how long it takes to get a patent. And there are other issues as well, but those are kind of the main ones that make up that discussion as to the system being broken.
I think Steve's dead on. The choice of word there, crisis, is really interesting because over the last several years, let's say, that word has been used by a bunch of different players in the patent community for different purposes. So I think everybody's kind of has their different definition of that, and they're using it for different things. In the broad sense, is there a crisis in our patent system? I would answer that with a yes. Clearly there is, but to flush it out a little bit, you've got to talk specifically about who's asking that question.
Okay, so one of the aspects of the system that may be in crisis is the ability for plaintiffs who are seeking to enforce their patents to obtain sometimes just jaw-dropping awards, such as the one that Alcatel received against Microsoft concerning its patent over, or whether it has a patent or not, I guess, is one of the issues in the case, over MP3 technology. And that award was just recently set aside by the judge who presided over the case. Can you guys weigh in on that and help us understand what happened there?
This is Matt. I'm not familiar with the specific details of that case, but it certainly follows a familiar fact pattern that we've seen several times over the last several years. But
$1.52 billion judgment set aside, jury verdict set aside by the judge.
Yeah, and the jaw-dropping, what a great descriptor for that, because, you know, we keep seeing a lot of these damage awards, and they seem to get higher and higher and higher in these patent cases. And certainly that's one of our crises. The danger with it, though, with examining that, is what if there is an invention that certainly is worth that amount? Or what if someone truly did suffer damages to that degree? The hardware, the computer manufacturers, and the software guys are frustrated by this because they typically deal with, when they launch a new product, they typically deal with thousands of patents, meaning that they're up against potentially thousands of lawsuits just by the nature of what they make and what they sell. And any given one of those patents under the current law could prevent them from launching their product or result in some sort of damage award. And under the current law, could result in a damage award like the one you mentioned. So they've got an interest on one side that they want to rein in these damages to more accurately reflect what the particular invention is relevant to inside of their product. Maybe it's not the total value, but maybe it's some small fraction of the product being manufactured, the infringing product. On the other side, though, is the biotech and the pharma companies of the world and the medical device companies of the world. And they typically don't face these huge patent portfolios when they go to launch a product. They might face just a handful of patents just by the nature of what they make and what they sell. And in that context, an infringing product might accurately be reflected by a larger damage award because the patent claim might cover the entire product. So there's these two competing interests at stake when you're looking at that particular crisis.
Denise, this is Brad. And Matt makes a good point. It's sort of my perspective on it, though, as working in-house for a large computer OEM, hardware OEM, original equipment manufacturer, I look at it from the perspective, I have no problem with an inventor being awarded a reasonable royalty on a patent. But the problem is that the current system has skewed that constitutional nomenclature such that it's not necessarily the inventor, and it's not necessarily a reasonable royalty. For example, let's assume that I get a letter, an infringement letter, from the holder of a patent that covers one piece of a computer that has 1,000 different components. And the price that I pay for that widget is a penny, let's say. But under the current scheme, he's entitled to a reasonable royalty on the entire sales price of that computer. So I paid a penny for the widget. The computer sells for $1,000. The current scheme contemplates or calculates his reasonable royalty based on that $1,000 sales price. That's a problem for me as a hardware OEM. Moreover, the constitutional scheme contemplates patent rights accrue to the inventor, but this may not be an inventor. In fact, I received patent licensing demands from a number of individuals who were so far removed from the inventor, it was almost laughable. In fact, in one case, one of the patentees who asserted a patent against my company was a company that had acquired the patent in a bankruptcy sale for $50,000. And they were asserting rights and expecting damages of millions of dollars based on that fire sale in which they acquired the patent for $50,000. That, to me, evidences something wrong.
Yeah, that's a really good segue into the pending patent reform proposals. Can you guys tell me whether some sort of limitation on the assignability of patents and the damages that one might be able to recover from one that you pick up in a fire sale, whether that's something that's encompassed in the pending reform proposals?
This is Steve. I don't know that I've seen anything like that in the current in the current rules or the suggested legislation. I know they've dealt with apportionment, which is the issue Brad is talking about, where damages are related to the portion that the improvement made, instead of picking some number, like an Alcatel case where they had picked, I think it was half of a percent of the computer price for every computer in which Windows was installed.
Did any of you take a good look at the ruling that set aside the damage judgment in that case?
Yeah, I'd seen a little bit of it. I guess there was two patents that were involved. And one thing happened here, too, is the impact of that KSR, the Supreme Court case, KSR. I mean, the jury came to its conclusion in March, and obviously just now the judge is setting that aside. And the reasons he had used on those two patents were, one of them had to do with ownership and whether there was standing to sue on one of the patents. And the other one was he had made the determination based upon and citing the KSR case that he thought the invention was obvious.
Right, and that's a really, really important case in patent jurisprudence right now, isn't it?
Well, it is going to be. One of the problems, though, I mean, it's also an exception as well, in that we're talking about a case that fell, you know, obviously the award and all the legal arguments that took place, presuming, you know, we can presume that there were summary judgment motions that were made before that were denied. But now, after KSR, now suddenly the judge is considering that. You know, whether or not that case would have gone all the way to trial before or after KSR would be, you know, we just don't know.
Yeah, and we should explain to the listeners that the KSR, it's KSR versus Teleflex, is that right?
Yes.
Supreme Court case decided recently, within the last 2-3 years.
KSR just recently came down.
And it is in the realm of raising the bar for what constitutes non-obvious. One of the requirements for getting a patent is, of course, that the invention not be obvious, that there not have been prior art along those same lines. And one of the big complaints, and the reason that a lot of people do view the patent system as in crisis, is so many patents are getting through the system that are of quote-unquote poor quality. In other words, they're things where lots of people feel like a patent should never have been granted for that in the first place. So
right.
I guess what you're telling me is the judge in this Alcatel case looked at KSR and the new standard that had been set there and the leeway he had to examine the patent, and he decided that this high bar for non-obviousness under KSR hadn't been met. Am I summing that up correctly?
Yeah, I mean, that's that is what it looks like the judge had decided. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where the Supreme Court really didn't rewrite patent law. You know, the Supreme Court originally had that Deere decision and kind of left it up to the federal courts, you know, and more recently the Federal Circuit to kind of interpret what that meant and how to apply that. And the Federal Circuit had established this, what was called the teaching suggestion motivation test, to kind of help courts determine whether or not an invention or even the patent office was obvious. And that KSR case was really the Supreme Court going back and saying, no, it's really that original test we came up with, the Deere factors that apply, and not exclusively this teaching suggestion motivation test that the Federal Circuit has come up with. You know, those elements are still important to the overall decision, but they don't make or break the case, whether or not there was teaching or suggestion or motivation.
Can you explain that a little? How does that analysis go, the teaching suggestion motivation test?
Well, you know, I'm trying to think. I think Matt had a real good example of that.
Did I?
You did.
I can put it in a nutshell. Obviousness, Denise, typically... another requirement for patentability is anticipation. It has to be something that's not new. And when you're looking at anticipation or novelty, the examiner in the patent office or whoever's trying to invalidate an issued patent has to find the entire claimed invention in a single reference. So in the four corners of one document, basically. Under obviousness, though, there's no limitation that has to be in a single document. You can combine a couple references to come up with every feature of the claimed invention, or you can take a single reference and combine it with maybe some knowledge that's known in the art or something like that. So you can make these combinations to kind of assemble the claimed invention to show that it was obvious. And the Federal Circuit's teaching suggestion motivation test essentially over time became this litmus test for obviousness in the way that they applied it. And the test in a nutshell was, okay, I've got these two references or a single reference plus a piece of knowledge or something like that, and I want to combine them so that I can show that I've got the entire claimed invention. And what the Federal Circuit's test does is it says, okay, if you've got these two things and you want to combine them, you have to show me that there's a teaching of all the elements, and then you have to show me that there's some sort of a suggestion or a motivation for someone to make that proposed combination. And the way the test was elevated was it basically became this litmus test where if there wasn't an explicit teaching or motivation or something like that, then the test would fail, meaning that the proposed obviousness, rejection, or attack would fail also. And the Supreme Court in KSR said, you guys are wrong to have elevated this test, this litmus test status for obviousness. It's important. These factors are important, but certainly it doesn't make or break an obviousness case.
So what else does the Supreme Court want courts and the patent office looking at then?
Well, that's the interesting side of KSR. It's one of these great Supreme Court cases that has so much language in it that I think it's going to take a long time to truly figure out what comes out of it. Steve alluded to the Graham v. John Deere case from years ago. That's kind of it's the bellwether case for obviousness law. And the Supreme Court in KSR pointed everybody back to Graham v. John Deere and said, here's the factors for obviousness. You have to go through this analysis of the prior art and the differences between the claimed invention and the prior art. And basically you come down to this case-by-case analysis to determine if something was obvious or not. But in addition to pointing back to Graham v. John Deere, they threw out all these other phrases and language and things like that that I think over time is really going to change our obviousness law a little bit. They used the term ordinary innovation several times in the opinion. There's this notion that, well, maybe this claimed invention is just the result of ordinary innovation, and if that's true, then maybe it is obvious. So I think we'll see that kind of develop over the coming years. But I don't think we're really going to know that until we just let the case sit for a while and let the courts get a hold of it and let the patent office interpret it and let industry interpret it as well.
I mean, you know, I agree completely with Matt there that, you know, we've got this KSR case that was big. I mean, the changes that it's, you know, what it's going to cause is it's going to cause some great changes in the whole system. And, you know, right now, we don't know where those changes are going. We don't know what the impact is going to be on the patent system. We don't know what the impact is going to be on allowance or validity. But yet we're still in this you know, quote-unquote crisis mode where everyone feels they need to make drastic changes to the patent system, whether that's through legislative reform, whether that's through the patent office's own internal rulemaking. You know, as a practitioner, it's troublesome not knowing where KSR is going to take us, and then to keep tweaking bits and pieces and making massive changes in the meantime. It's like watching an episode of House on TV, and you know, seeing where they have they can't figure out what causes the problem, and so they've made these drastic changes and are trying about 20 different drugs, not knowing which one's going to fix the problem, what the side effects are. It's the same thing here with that KSR case and different types of reform.
So is this realm of obviousness what's involved in the whole debate around software patents and whether or not they are appropriate, or are there other factors that come into play as well?
For software patents, I think there's other factors that come into play. I tend to look at that issue as a level above the obviousness issue. But there's a camp out there, a very vocal and very active camp, that think that software, just by its nature, should not be included in the realm of patentable subject matter. So we don't even get to the obviousness issue. They just think that it should be carved out of patentable subject matter. And that's a debate, obviously, for us as a society to have. You know, do we think that software should be patentable subject matter? That part of the patent code doesn't get interpreted very often. In the late 70s or 80s or so, we addressed the issue of whether genetically modified life forms should be included in the realm of patentable subject matter. And that was a tough debate at the time, and, you know, lo and behold, we came out and we said, yeah, that it is, as long as it was somehow modified by man or some sort of man-made contribution. But in software, that's the new debate, and people wonder if it should be included in patentable subject matter.
And
if it is... If it is included, then we would get to the obviousness issue, and that's where we stand today. It is considered patentable today, so it has to go under the obviousness analysis.
Right, and so that's what happened in this recent case that was dismissed against Real Networks. Were you guys following that at all?
I had seen some of that as well. The problem with obviousness in software goes back a long way. I mean, obviously, when you're talking about software, you're talking about the difference between having source code that contains how it's working and you know, the code that is released that ends up being secret. And so software's kind of progressed through history with this element of secrecy as to how it works, which causes great problems to the patent office when they're examining software patents and trying to issue rejections against later filed software applications. Where they don't have a huge repository of old prior art to go back and cite against these patents. And so how the industry has typically dealt with it over time has been to, when one of these patents comes up that has obviousness problems, litigation has been the way to kind of bring that out and deal with those issues.
Steve brings up a good point. With software, a lot of these patents get out there and immediately the technical field looks at it and says, hey, we've been doing this for years. How could they have gotten a patent on that? And the patent office, you know, I'm not one to feel sorry for the patent office very often, but I feel sorry for them when it comes to software patents, because the examiners, like Steve says, they just don't have access to the most relevant prior art. And for us as a society, that's a real problem, because these bad patents are getting out there because of that. And leaning a little bit into personal opinion on the matter, I tend to think that there's no reason to carve software out of patentable subject matter as a definitional issue. But I tend to think let's bolster up the patent office's capabilities and make sure they have access to the latest and greatest and best prior art sources. And if they did have that, I think that the amount of bad patent, quote-unquote bad patents in the software area would be reduced dramatically.
So one thing that's been in the news a lot lately is the Peer to Patent Project. Is that positioned to provide the latest and greatest and best in prior art examinations by opening it up to the community and letting the wisdom of the crowds inform the USPTO?
Yeah, it is. In theory, I think it's a way to go about giving them that access. Certainly, there are different ways to do it. For software, for example, I think plugging the examiners into the most relevant databases would probably be the best way to do it. But the peer to patent is just another way of doing that. And if the community participates in that, which is the big if on that, if they do participate and they provide good input, certainly it would go it would make great inroads into reducing the bad patents problem.
What's your impression of how it's doing so far? Is it just too early to tell?
I think it's too early to tell. I don't know if anybody else has any other opinions, but you know, we're just getting underway with that. So I think the next year or so will be interesting to watch.
Okay, so we've made it through all but a couple of other items on my current event list here, one of which is the recent echoing that in the Merck Exchange versus eBay case, an injunction is not appropriate. Someone want to tell us what's going on there and why this is a good thing? How about our litigator, Brad?
Well, I haven't had direct experience with that case yet. It simply hasn't come up. But I do know that anything that causes a court to be more meticulous in its investigation of whether an injunction is warranted is certainly good from my perspective. Because, as you know, and I'll ask Matt and Steve to correct me if I'm wrong, historically the injunctions were typically just granted almost pro forma. You just got an injunction when you filed a patent infringement lawsuit. And so to have the benefit of some additional analysis as to the merits on a fairness kind of a standard, certainly I think benefits the players, particularly from my perspective, typically looking at it from a defendant's perspective. It certainly injects an element of fairness that I think personally had been missing before. Steve and Matt, what do you guys think?
I would agree with Brad on that one. The Federal Circuit had been, they had a rule in place that basically, like you said, Brad, if you ask for an injunction, you got it. And that was kind of the crux of the eBay case. And once again, the Supreme Court told the Federal Circuit, look, guys, your rule is wrong and it shouldn't be done this way. And they pointed the courts back to some law, you know, the traditional four-factor test for injunctions. And they said, you know, we apply this four-factor test everywhere else. We should also apply it here in the patent world. But again, just like KSR, it's another one of these cases where I think we have to let it sit and percolate for a while to see how it's played out and how the lower courts are treating it and handling it. Because now they've got full discretion to apply those four factors and decide if an injunction is warranted. And I have a feeling that some courts are going to come down on the side of patent holders and other courts will come down on the side of infringers or alleged infringers.
In fact, within the last 2 months, or sometime shortly after the case came down, I read anecdotally about the first application of the case in which a court did not enter an injunction. And I hope one of you maybe are more familiar with that case, but in the last couple of months, there was a case in which a judge did not just, you know, enter the injunction automatically, like may have been the case, applying a Merck Exchange, and applied the four factors and found that on these facts, the injunction would not be warranted. So there you go. There is at least one case I'm familiar with in which there was a real-world application, and we don't know the outcome of that. We don't know whether the plaintiff was harmed or whether there was a bad outcome as a result of the injunction not being automatically granted, but at least we see, at least I have some experience with that, with one case in which it was applied. Do either of you know that case I'm talking about by chance?
I followed it closely when it first came. This case is, coming up on 2 years ago or a year and a half ago. But right after that came out, there was a case maybe in Texas or something, and I think it involved Microsoft as the defendant. And then I know there were a couple others as well. I think they, you know, somebody going against Microsoft, some sort of code in the Windows system or something like that. And they said, yeah, no injunction. But the interesting thing with that case is even without getting a decision from the court as to whether or not an injunction should or should not be granted, that fundamentally changes the bargaining table in a patent lawsuit. Because the biggest threat that a patent holder had, and that's what Brad was alluding to earlier, was the power to shut you down. I have a single patent that covers something in your product. It might be the entire product, or it might be component number 722 of 10,000.
Matt, let me interject and say, it maybe covers some aspect of the product, right?
Right?
Yeah. I mean, maybe,
right, exactly.
Maybe. And so there you go. That's the problem. But go ahead.
Yeah, and that was the power of a patent holder over a big manufacturer's, you know, with this single patent that maybe covers the entire product or just a part of it, I can basically threaten to shut you down. And under the old regime, more than likely I'd get an injunction if I was able to get to that point of the game.
And so what was the outcome of that? When there was a threatened injunction and you knew it was going to be entered, what did you do if you were at the receiving end of that assertion? What would you do? You'd roll over and take a license. You'd roll over and take a license because you couldn't have your manufacturing lines shut down, right. Sort of just de facto. And so you would, even without getting to the merits, I mean, how often in patent litigation do you really get to the merits? Never. Well, that's why, because right. You've got this injunction hanging over your head. And so now at least maybe we can actually get to the substantive merits of some of these cases. I think it's terrific.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a question as to how many of them are going to settle now, but also as to whether or not there's an impact on the number of filings. Whether taking that away from potential litigants was enough to make those cases go away, whether or not worth filing or not now. And I'm not sure if that's been really studied yet at all.
So it takes a bit of power out of the sword that is a patent. You used to be able to go in and basically shut down somebody who you claimed was infringing without having to demonstrate really that any infringement had taken place, because you would do this early on in the litigation process, get an injunction, grind everything to a stop, and then, as Brad was saying, rather than grind through that process, take a license and get on with your business.
Well, I was thinking that was applying, and correct me if I'm wrong, I was applying to judgments that, you know, that was applying to the appeal process. Versus this, you know, seeking some kind of a preliminary injunction regarding infringement. But I guess I could be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it applies to patents that have already gone a little bit of a distance in the sense that it's been shown that they're valid and infringed. But you have to put that in context in patent litigation where an appeal is almost a matter of course. So it's early in the stages of the whole patent litigation game because every patent litigation that means anything will go up on appeal.
Okay, so let me clarify my own understanding here. In the wake of Merck Exchange now and this reaffirmation of it that we've recently had, the fact that your ultimate remedy might be an injunction from the trial court is no longer a done deal. Is that accurate?
Correct.
Right. You know, that you would have the injunction while the entire case was on appeal. You know, and as Matt was saying, I mean, these cases, every single time they get appealed, and the appeal process takes years and years and years.
And so the motivations remain the same. Given those facts, right, I mean, you still are more likely to take a license and settle, given the alternative. So I still think it creates benefits.
So, yeah, and then, Denise, another thing that you had said was it eats away at the power of the sword of a patent. And I would agree with that on a limited basis, I think. I think it eats away at the power of the sword for certain patent holders. And it doesn't so much for others. Big companies that have big patent portfolios and, you know, patent litigation is a matter of business that they just do. I don't know that it changes much for them. It might factor into their file or no file decision on the lawsuit, but I don't think it changes much for them. But the small guys, you know, the guys that are holding a single patent, maybe covers a component, and dare I say a patent troll, I think it definitely eats away at the power of their sword.
So again, on the current litigation front, one thing much in the headlines lately is the outcome of the longstanding SCO versus IBM case and SCO versus Novell. Brad, can you kind of bring us up to speed on where things stand there now and whether there's anything left of that litigation after the summary judgment ruling that just came out?
Sure, Denise. It's interesting. It has been going on a long time, and on August 10th, Judge Dale Kimball issued a memorandum opinion that says succinctly, and I will read from the opinion, on page 99 of a 102-page opinion, Judge Kimball says, "For the reasons stated above, the court concludes that Novell is the owner of the Unix and Unixware copyrights." So this is not inherently a patent case. There are patent ramifications downstream, but fundamentally this was about copyright. And so SCO, the acronym used to be Santa Cruz Operation, but they changed their name to SCO Group, sued both IBM and Novell in federal district court in Utah in separate cases, essentially in cases arising out of copyright. And so this is not the main case, as we say. We always have looked to the SCO versus, or the SCO versus IBM as the main case. That case was filed in, let's see, that case was filed in March of 2003, and they were seeking $5 billion in damages, alleging that IBM had improperly appropriated portions of the Unix code into IBM's version of Linux. The Novell case, the one in which we got the ruling from Judge Kimball, actually was different. The principal allegation there, that was filed in January of 2004, the principal allegation was slander of title, because Novell was taking the position that it owned the copyright in Unix and Unixware, and SCO was concerned about the effect of that allegation on its main IBM litigation, so it sued Novell for slander of title. But as a function of that, after all the machinations for the past 3 years, the judge has determined that Novell actually owns those copyrights. And the opinion is interesting. It's really not a copyright opinion. It's a contract construction case, because that's what the whole case boiled down to, is whether or not Novell had assigned the copyrights to Caldera Systems when it sold the Unix code to that entity or its predecessor in 1995. And so it's a contract case. But at the end of the day, Novell is now the owner of the Unix and Unixware copyrights by this decree. And so the outcome should be, I think in the IBM case, IBM is going to now run to the judge and say, well, guess what? SCO no longer has standing to allege copyright counts as to us because Novell is the owner of the copyrights. And that, in a nutshell, is what that August 10th decision was about, Denise.
Great. So it is as final as it seems, it sounds like.
Well, yeah, and I guess if we want to move a little bit now into the kind of the open source software piece, I was thinking about this and realized, well, let's think about this for a minute. If Novell owns the copyright to Unix, and one of the fundamental allegations or one of the problems in the open source movement is whether or not Linux and the variant operating systems are really open source, the question becomes, well then, has any of Unix been appropriated into, and any of Unix found its way or been appropriated into various of the Linux kernels? And that was one of the issues in this case, is whether or not Linux, and that in particular the IBM case, was whether or not Linux incorporated any of the Unix code such that there would be an infringement of SCO's copyrights. Well, that's been addressed, right? It's not SCO's copyright any longer, but more fundamentally, the issue becomes, has any of that Unix code found its way into the Linux kernel? Because Linux, as you know, is subject to the whole open software movement and the general public license and all that stuff. And so if Unix has been incorporated into those Linux kernels, then we have a different issue. Linus Torvalds, we'll call him the author of Linux, maintains that, of course not. No Unix code found its way into Linux, the Linux kernel. But that creates an issue, and it creates a downstream issue relative to the whole open source, you know, software movement.
And is it a patent issue?
Well, you know what? I guess it can be, and I'll look to obviously to Steve and Matt to correct me. It can be, Denise, to the extent we're talking about whether Linux, the means by which Linux is licensed. Because many open source platforms, including Linux and the various flavors of Linux, are licensed pursuant to something like the GNU General Public License, or the GPL as it's called. And as you may know, there was just recently promulgated by the Free Software Foundation a new version of the GPL, version 3.0, and it does have patent implications in it. So backtracking, if Unix, which the copyright is owned by Novell, has found its way into Linux, and the open source license, the GNU General Public License, somehow contemplates that it's truly all open source, then the provisions within GPL that relate to patents may be messed up because it's truly not all open source. If you see my point, it starts at copyright, but it kind of transmogrifies, to use the Calvin and Hobbes word, into a patent issue by virtue of GPL.
Right.
Steve and Matt, I mean, are you guys up on that? Do you have a comment about that?
You know, I mean, I haven't followed that. I haven't followed that at all.
Well, so then, Denise, yes, I think there is a patent issue to the extent the underlying source code, the underlying Linux kernel, or the underlying open source stuff is truly not open source, then there are downstream ramifications for licensees under GPL. I think the answer is yes.
Okay, so getting back to the original point of whether Unix has made its way into Linux or portions of it have,
yeah.
Where is the patent on Unix? Who holds that?
Well, I certainly can't answer that. I don't think we know that Novell owns the copyrights, but I don't believe there was ever a patent on Unix.
Okay.
Yeah, who knows if there is one, or if there is one, maybe there's more than one.
That would be the ultimate software patent.
Yeah, right.
But amen.
I don't know that that's out there.
All right. Okay, because part of Microsoft's recent saber rattling, right, has been that parts of its patented technology have made its way into Linux. And that is part of the whole drama of GPL version 3, is it not?
It is. And Microsoft, as you know, took the position some months back that no fewer than 235 Microsoft patents were infringed by Linux. And so the Linux community, of course, got up in arms about that. And I think maybe not as a direct function of that, but you've read in the trade publications how within the last year, Microsoft entered into a pact with Novell that Microsoft would not assert its patents against the Novell flavor of SUSE Linux. So so there you go. If, in fact, Microsoft has 235 patents that read on Linux, why would it do this deal where it enters into a non-assertion covenant with Novell in which it says, well, we won't assert these patents against any of your customers, Novell, in exchange for $40 million in cash? Interesting, I think, that Microsoft chose to do it that way.
It's a great illustration of the thicket that surrounds the software patent issue.
Could you expand on that?
Well, you know, when you're talking about software patents, like we've talked about earlier, it involves this question of whether or not the invention was novel in the first place, and we know there's challenges with determining that because we just don't have access to the prior art. And then on top of that, when you're looking at a product to determine if it involves patented technology or not, you're typically not looking at just one patent, you're looking at hundreds of them, maybe even thousands of them. That in a nutshell is a couple of great bullet points on the software patent issue and why people get so up in arms about it. It's a real problem.
So how does GPL version 3 attempt to deal with that problem?
Well, there are four pieces to GPL version 3, which was promulgated and became effective on June 27th, just as a matter of trivia. But there are four parts to it that talk about these issues. The first is that it contains an express, and some of these are not different from version 2.0, by the way. Some of these are just straight across the same as version 2.0, but these are the four patent issues in version 3.0, or I guess they can just call it GPL v3. First of all, there is a non-assertion covenant, which says that if you license if you take a license under GPL version 3, you may not initiate litigation alleging that any patent claim is infringed by making, using, or selling the licensed program. So, first point is, if you take a license under GPL, you have to look and see what's in your portfolio because you're agreeing not to assert any of your patents against somebody who might be using the licensed program. Non-assertion covenant is the first thing that it does. The second thing is that it grants a patent license to any of the programs licensed under GPL. So you are granted not only a copyright license, but a patent license by GPL. And that's, as you know, a little bit atypical for a software license. The GPL is typically thought of as a software license, but this actually grants an express patent license to downstream holders. The third thing that GPL does with respect to patents is that it says if you are incorporating any upstream stuff into your program that's licensed under GPL, and that upstream stuff is subject to a patent, you have to be able to make sure that you can grant good rights to the downstream users of your product. So this is, again, just indicative of the whole of how aggressive Free Software Foundation feels about software patents. They say, if you're going to incorporate something into a GPL 3.0 product, and it's subject to an upstream patent, you've got to be able to make sure you grant those rights, even if it says, I'm reading from the license, even if it means you have to arrange to deprive yourself of the benefit of the patent license for this particular work. So they're serious about it. And the last thing is they've added a specific provision in GPL version 3 that defeats the Novell Microsoft deal. They specifically say, it's sort of interesting, it's very pointed. Let me just quickly read it. I won't read the whole thing, but it says, you may not convey a covered work that's covered by this license if you are a party to an arrangement with a third party that is in the business of distributing software. Who do you think that is? Under which you make payment to the third party based on the extent of your activity of conveying the work. So if there's any deals out there in which you've agreed to pay somebody money in exchange for them not suing your customers, You can't license your work under GPL version 3. So it's fairly comprehensive from a patent perspective. It does a nice job. Some people think it's over expansive, but I think it addresses a lot of these open source issues very well.
In a strange way, it almost reminds me of Creative Commons, because you know it's an attempt to deal with a problematic legal area that has been identified in a contractual sort of way, except for it probably goes a whole lot further. You know, the analogy begins to break down because it does so many different things than Creative Commons does. It's a licensing strategy, but it is a much more detailed one.
Agreed. And from Stephen Matt's perspective, I think it creates an issue for patent practitioners. And I think, and I'll ask you guys, if you were going to counsel a client with respect to software patents, given how expansive some of these patent provisions are, it seems like due diligence would require a practitioner to say to their client, well, let's look at your software. Are all these kernels that are on which it's based truly open source? Is it subject to any upstream patents? How are you going to license this thing? And if GPL is involved, it creates some new levels of due diligence to make sure that all those rights are properly addressed. I mean, Steve and Matt, what do you guys think about that?
I think you're right. Those are things you've got to factor in. And you've got to, in doing that, you've got to go outside of just what the traditional issues that come up, and you're going to have to, whether that means getting up to speed in that or hiring on a practitioner that is up to speed in GPL, you're going to have to do it.
So did GPL sort of unintentionally create a full employment act for lawyers?
Well, my two cents on that would be no, because frankly, although admittedly this open source movement is, it's very grassroots and it's gaining traction, my sense is that most of the world still wants to be fairly proprietary with their software. So it's you know what, it all sounds good and it gives you a warm fuzzy to say, hey, I'm licensing my stuff under Creative Commons, or I'm licensing it under GPL and everybody can use it, and go, you know, let's all go copy left. Unless Steve and Matt disagree, I still think the world recognizes there's a great deal of value inherent in being proprietary about your intellectual property, particularly your software. And by golly, I'm going to charge a royalty, and by golly, I'm going to make sure that you can't, you know, make copies of it, even, and I'm going to make sure that you can't do any of those other things that copyright and patent law protect. So, you know what? I think it's kind of a tempest in a teapot, but I'm interested to see what Steve and Matt have to say. I think that most of the world still wants to protect their IP.
Well, speaking as a patent attorney, I would agree with that. Most of my clients want to protect their IP. I can give you an anecdote. Steve and I together have worked with a couple guys in the open source movement, and it's been interesting to watch them because you know, we work with them on a couple projects, and they'll tell us we want this to all be open, and we want to do this, we want to do that, and everybody can have it, and Creative Commons and GPL. Well. Over time, they put together a group, and they get an identity, and they have some trademarks, and they have some software that maybe they've written and everything. And then all of a sudden, people start taking it, taking their stuff. And lo and behold, they come back to us, and I say, well, we don't want them taking our stuff. These people are using our name or our trademark or our software or something, and what do we do about that? So it's almost one of these problems like, you know, a lot of people are very pro open source and pro, better term for it, but free exchange of IP until it's their IP that gets used by others without permission. And then when they experience that, they see their own stuff getting used maybe without permission or even maybe without payment of some sort, then sometimes their opinions on it changes a little bit.
Did you guys get the chance to watch the video I put in our show links with David Kapos of IBM?
I didn't yet. It looked like it was an hour long or so, wasn't it?
No, it's only like 20 minutes long.
Oh.
He was one of the people on the patent panel. I saw it always on. Really good. And one of the things, the reason I bring it up now is that one of the things he said both on the panel and in that video is, you know, reemphasizing IBM's commitment to open source, although he did say that IBM has not gone to using version 3 of the GPL, is still working with version 2 at this point, as I suppose will Microsoft, to the extent that, you know, covering its open source dabblings. And you know, I mean, you guys are right to emphasize that the open source model is still new, but I do encourage you to watch that video, because Kapos is the head intellectual property counsel for IBM, and his commitment to open source was palpable, you know, when you heard him speak.
Denise, let me ask you a question, because I didn't watch the video. But let's think about that for a minute. When a company whose principal asset, in many respects, is intellectual property, why would you give it away? When you have responsibilities to shareholders to derive revenue from your assets, and if your principal asset is IP, why give it away? You know what I mean? Why would a landlord allow tenants to stay in a property for free? And I'm not anti-open source. I'm just saying that in many respects, there might just be something going on here for the sake of appearances. So, for example, like the Open Invention Network that we're familiar with, in which people are contributing patents to this portfolio, and everybody participates, and then nobody agrees to, we all agree not to sue each other. Well, are any of their key foundational, really valuable patents or IP as in part of those shared protocols? I don't know. I kind of doubt it. But, I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, why would somebody whose principal asset is intellectual property or one of their main assets is IP, why would they give it away? And that's what open source is.
Right. I guess it's a question of what you're giving away. You know, I mean, the notion would be that you give away what you need to build out the infrastructure that you need and to create the community that you need to foster the rest of your intellectual property portfolio.
Right.
Well, the old way was to donate these things and write them off as a tax credit for their value. That kind of got cut out of the system, so maybe open sourcing them is the new way of at least getting some benefit out of surplus garage sale patents.
Right. And so how charitable and altruistic is it really when they're giving away the garage sale patents to the open source movement?
Well,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I mean, you guys are the patent specialists and I am not, but just from, you know, the conversations that I've had and the people I've heard speak, there does seem to be a commitment to do more than just give away the garage sale patents and really, you know, do license things that are important at certain levels of what the business is doing to support things that will go on top of them.
Agreed. Let me make one kind of smarmy quick comment, and that is this. There's a licensing consortium called MPEG-LA, and they're the guys that out-license the MPEG patent portfolio. And we all know what MPEG is, and we know how important it is. That is a multi-billion dollar patent, and they get lots of money from licensing revenues. If somebody like MPEG-LA contributed the MPEG patents to an open source consortium, I would fall over dead, because I just don't see it trending that way. So when somebody like MPEG-LA gets on board with open source, I think then I will be a believer.
And I think, like you said, Denise, I think you have to look at what it is they're giving away. You also have to look at what it is they're getting in return. IBM's not getting rid of their licensing program anytime soon. I mean, it's one of the best and most successful in the world. They're certainly getting something in return as far as appearing as a company that actively supports open source movement. And I don't say that to say that they're doing it just for appearances, because I agree with you, Denise. I think there is something palpable there. And I think what's going on is I think that they're kind of just testing the waters. They're trying to figure it out. I think all these software and computer companies are really trying to figure out what it means to their business and how they can participate in it. What's the benefit of being part of it, and what's the potential detriment of not joining in? IBM and some other companies have signed on with the peer-to-patent program, and they've even said, you know what, we'll dedicate some hours, some employee hours to this project, and we'll let our employees spend company time looking at patent applications and writing comments and reviewing prior art. So I think there is something there. They're interested in participating in open source and better patents and all that kind of stuff. But my personal opinion is I think they're doing it in a sense that they're dipping their toes in the water and they're trying to figure out how it affects them and what it means to them.
Yeah, my impression is they're starting to figure out that there are not just altruistic and PR goals to be achieved, that they actually can get palpable benefits out of involving a community in the development of their own products. And particularly, you know, the infrastructural aspects of them.
I would agree with that. I mean, the web over the last couple of years, if it's shown us anything, it's shown us the power of the community. And I have a feeling that maybe part of that experimentation that they're doing is, you know, how can we be involved in the community and how can we build some good relationships where we can pull something out of the community.
So I guess that sort of covers the in a succinct way. We could spend all day, I think, talking about open source and intellectual property, but it covers sort of the GPL version 3 and and what's going on there, and the fact that there's sort of a tussle involved in its adoption and what it's trying to accomplish. The other thing that we've touched on is, you know, the sort of slow-moving wheels of government to try and address some of the issues in the patent system. And Steve, when we were exchanging emails before the show, you were saying that you'd be happy to comment on the eBay to KSR to legislation to secret USPTO regulations thing, which I thought was wonderful. And, you know, we have talked about eBay, Merck Exchange, and KSR. So why don't you you finish up our chat here by bringing us up to speed on what's going on in the legislative world and with the USPTO regulations.
Well, you know, and I'll punt to Matt on the patent reform legislation side of things. That's kind of where he's an expert. You know, so we've got, obviously, case law has changed with that KSR case. Congress is moving forward with patent reform legislation, and the USPTO itself is changing the regulations as to how applications are examined and other things to kind of address the problems they see. Some of them deal with bad patents. Some of them deal with patent pendency. What's been frustrating for me as a practitioner in counseling my clients is that the patent office, at least on the pendency side point, has a number of years ago raised patent fees. They said that applicants are spending too much time. There's these abuses taking place, so we'll compensate for that by raising patent fees. You know, so they had gone through a process of raising fees and making other changes, and now they've come back to us lately and have a number of different changes which a lot of the patent law community is having issues with because they're being made secretly. They've gone through the process of determining the new regulations and determining how they're going to apply, only to spring them on us and give us, you know, 60 days, 30 days to oppose them via Federal Register or Official Gazette implementation, and then they're effective. And some of those deal with the number of claims an applicant can make, the types of claims they can make, the number of continuation applications. For instance, as long as you keep an application pending, you can spin off additional applications claiming priority to it. So if I file an application and there ends up being two inventions in it, I can spin off one of the two inventions into a separate application. And as new information it comes in, as the inventive process keeps moving forward and new inventions are developed, those new inventions can be added in as continuation part applications. Each of those paying separate filing fees to cover their cost of examination. And some of the new rules look like they're going to change how many continuation applications you can file. And one of the other issues that we're seeing pop up in some of these proposed, you know, we call them secret because no one's seen them yet. We've seen commentation on what is going to be in the rules, but no one's actually seen the actual rules yet until they're published. But one of them some of them have to do with changing the burden to where they're having applicants make more and more affirmative statements on the record as to what is patentable, what the prior art says, versus what they're seeking protection of. Things that cause horrible problems down the road in litigation when you have the applicant making statements that can be used essentially against them in court. So it's an interesting time as a patent practitioner right now to see the changes that are coming down the pipe to us. And all of this has taken place, of course, before we know the impact of KSR and what that's going to do for patent allowance rates, what that's going to do for the litigation side of things. So it can be it's challenging and scary, I guess, at the same time.
Matt, you want to speak to the legislation piece of what's going on?
Yeah, I guess just to follow up with what Steve said is it's a tremendous time in patent law right now. It's incredibly interesting. We've got reform efforts underway in all three branches of government. I mean, the Supreme Court, at the highest levels of all three branches, and the Supreme Court over the last couple of years has taken on a crazy number of patent cases, and they've fundamentally rewritten good portions of the law. The Patent Office is implementing significant changes in the various rules and regulations that they oversee. And in Congress, we've been turning away at patent reform legislation for several years now. Up to this point, we have made zero progress, if you measure progress by, you know, enacting law. But over the last several years, there's been a tremendous effort inside Congress as far as making significant changes to the law. And over the last 2 years, let's say, we've come to see that patent reform is a very politicized issue, which is interesting because patent legislation typically hasn't seen that. But all of a sudden, patent legislation now is not something that we can get a lot of votes on one side of the thing. We've seen a huge divide develop between two groups primarily, one being the software and hardware guys and the other being the biotech and pharmaceutical guys, and then there's a lot of people in the middle and they're trying to figure out where exactly they sit. But there's an enormous gulf between those two camps, and legislation has crept forward very slowly. In the last Congress, we saw a ton of activity with no movement. This Congress, we've seen a little bit of movement with not all that much activity in the way of hearings and such, but we've got bills that are being advanced. Now they've made it out of committee, and it looks like they're going to go forward a little bit. But I think what the effect is that now we're pushing these bills forward to the point where patent reform will now be looked at from a broader audience. We've gotten legislation out of committee, and you know, just by that happening, a lot of new people will open their eyes to it and start looking at it. I've had a lot of clients call me, and you know, I mean, I'm always one to talk to people about reform legislation, but a lot of my clients obviously just have no idea that it's going on, and all of a sudden they're aware of it. You know, smaller patent portfolio type clients, and they'll say, "Hey, what's going on? And how does this affect me? And where do I sit on the continuum here?" So I think that the effect of this Congress so far, by the little movement that they've made, is to pull in a bunch of new people into the debate. So it's not just between Micron and Eli Lilly anymore. Now it's between, you know, some of the smaller companies in the country, and they're trying to figure out what it means to them.
There was a quote in one of the articles that we'll have in the show notes from lawyer Phil Johnson of Johnson & Johnson. I don't know if that's a coincidence or not. But Phil says, if the remedies for patent infringement are reduced, we lose the incentive to make investments because once we do, other people will simply rip us off. Is that pretty much indicative of the divide between the Microns and the Johnson & Johnsons of the world?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, no surprise, Phil falls on the Eli Lilly side of the debate. He's in the pharmaceutical camp. And, it's very indicative of the divide. The software and hardware manufacturers, you know, they're dealing with this problem that we talked about earlier. When they go to launch a product, they're looking at thousands and thousands of patents that might be asserted against them. And before eBay, the eBay decision, the Merck Exchange decision, they thought about the very real possibility that they could face an injunction on any one of those patents. The biotech and pharmaceutical guys, on the other side of things, they don't want anything to cut away at the fundamental value of a single patent because their products and their patent portfolios are typically much smaller. And like when a pharmaceutical company launches a product, they're looking at a smaller handful of patents, be it somebody else's or their own. And also, if you take it even a notch down from the big pharma guys, small biotech companies are very often launched on a single patent, maybe even a single patent application, and they go to funding based on the anticipated protections and value of that patent or patent application. And if some sort of legislation cuts away at the fundamental value of that, they're afraid that some of those companies won't get launched or some of those products won't get launched or those investments won't get made.
Well, guys, we've been going for a little over an hour here, so I'm going to go ahead and wind this down. We do have a sponsor for the show, and that is audible.com. And one thing we do whenever we record is try and give some recommendations to listeners that they can go to the audible.com site, audible.com/twit. And I'll here make my public request to Leo that we get a special Audible link for Twill. I don't think we have that set up yet. But if you go to audible.com/twit and sign up for a trial, you can get a free audiobook. And the couple that I came up with that kind of relate to the topics we've talked about on the show today is one called Great Inventors and Their Inventions by David Angus. Which I haven't yet read or listened to, but I'm going to put on my list after this. And then another one in a similar yet slightly different vein, because it's fiction, is a book I heard a lot about a couple of years ago called Einstein's Dreams. Have any of you read that one? By Alan Lightman?
I have not.
It looks quite wonderful. It follows a fictional account of Albert Einstein when he is a patent clerk in the patent office. So that looks like a fun one to check out as well. Did any of you guys have the chance to look at Audible and see if you had a recommendation that you might want to give our listeners?
Yeah, Denise, this is Steve. The one book that I've been reading lately, and I think a lot of the work I do is for small businesses and independent inventors, and a lot of times they have that question of what next? What's the next step, you know, in this process? And the book I've been reading lately that I think answers a lot of that questions for them is the 4-Hour Workweek book. From an attorney standpoint, that concept of only working 4 hours in a week, I think, is impossible. But at least from the standpoint of for those clients of mine that are kind of have a product or are wanting to get into building a side business, I think that book's great for them.
Great. Yeah, that's one that I've been meaning to read, because there are definitely work weeks these days when 4 hours is an ample amount for me. So, but part of my work gets to be doing fun shows with the likes of you guys. So it's all good work. So with that, I'd like to just thank you all so much for coming on the show today and sharing your thoughts and insights about the wonderful and complex world of patent law. Brad Fraser, we can find you online at internetlawyer.blogspot.com. That's your blog. Anything else you want to plug before we sign off here today?
No, thank you for plugging the blog, though, Denise. I appreciate it. Thanks for letting me participate. It was a great deal of fun.
Sure. Our pleasure. Great to have you. And then Matt Buchanan, you can find at promotetheprogress.com and at Focita. Is that Focita.com, Matt?
No, it's not. It's okpatents.com/Focita.
Right, but if someone enters that into a search engine, it's Phosita.
Yes. That's correct.
They'll come up with it, I think, in short order. And anything else you want to give a plug to, Matt, while we're wrapping things up here?
I won't plug anything, but I'll give an explanation. I'm on promotetheprogress.com. I've been on holiday, I'll call it, for the last several months, but I'm getting ready to gear up for the fall, so stay tuned.
And those are both affiliated with your law firm, correct?
Yeah, well, Promote the Progress is actually mine by myself, but Focita is the firm blog.
Got it. And then Steve Nipper has the Invent blog at inventblog.com. Anything else you want to mention? I should mention that both Matt and Steve also have a couple of joint projects together, along with Doug Sirocco, who was going to be on our call today but wound up getting called away to deal with a different crisis. And I've been enjoying your guys' collaborative efforts at rethinkip.com, and particularly at whatthefunnypatents, WTFpatents.com.
Yeah, that's one of them too.
Yeah.
Yep. Steve's responsible for the name, by the way.
Well, thanks for having me on, Denise.
It's really great to have you. Anything else you want to mention or point our listeners to?
No, not right now. So
there's one other thing that you guys do in connection with Rethink IP that people might be interested in, called Patent Fizz. Could you tell us what that is?
I'll let Matt give that explanation.
Yeah, actually, I'm upset at myself for not yet taking advantage of the opportunity to plug it when you originally asked me, because it's highly relevant to our conversation today. But Patent Fizz is an idea we had on the back of a napkin a couple years ago. And we thought, you know, this bad patents problem, or these obvious patents problem, what if we could somehow harness the power of the community and let anybody submit any comment on any patent, and make those comments part of a public record, and those comments will always be attached to the patent. So we built Patent Fizz to do exactly that. So you can log on to Patent Fizz, and you can type in a number of a issued United States patent, and it'll present the patent data kind of in a CSS kind of layout way, so it's better than looking at the actual patent documents. And then at the end of the page there for that patent, you can submit a comment. And you can submit a comment that says, this patent is awful, it should have never been granted. Yeah, it's fine, you can attach that. It won't mean much substantively, but if it makes you feel better, go ahead and submit that. But you can also submit an invalidity argument. If you want to post, you know, pieces of prior art and say that Claim 17 is obvious because this piece of prior art shows element X and this other piece of prior art shows element Y, and according to the Supreme Court's decision in KSR, it's obvious. If you want to submit something like that, you can do that, and it will be attached to the patent for all of the world to see. It's kind of similar to the peer-to-patent process or project in the sense that it opens up the patents to the community, but it kind of goes about it in a different way.
But this is for issued patents.
This is for issued patents, so it's not patent examination, but these are for patents that have already been granted by the patent office and people are in industry and people are dealing with.
That's wonderful. I encourage folks to check that out and check out all of the incredibly great blogs that these guys write. They're out there putting their knowledge around for you to use and learn from every single day, even when they go on brief hiatus. And I appreciate them doing that here today on the show, and really encourage you guys to check out the WTF Patents blog, because even if you're not in the mood for sort of heavy patent analysis, you can go there and see, I think the top entry right now is a picture of something completely indescribable, and you get to sort of decide what it is that patent is actually doing, what sort of device it is actually describing. And then there's links there to wonderful resources for all of your, sex toy related patents and all sorts of trivia and tidbits related to the patent world. So, guys, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for doing the show, and we'll see you on the internet.
Thanks, Denise.
Take care.
Thanks, Denise.